The music of Towers has gone through a radical evolution in its brief history. The brainchild of singer Derek Torres, what was once a five-piece indie rock band, has now become a one-man dance party with depth. Towers' music combines organic rock instrumentation and electronic sounds with sincere lyrics and strong melodies. The album TLDR, which is internet slang for Too Long Didn't Read, was released Tuesday by Winston-Salem's Fuzz Records. It's available on CD, online, and a white 12-inch vinyl. Towers is playing a release party Saturday at the Garage, and he'll be treating the audience to a somewhat rare 8-piece band performance. For details on the concert, visit WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. So they can take. With home recording and, or, you know, with recording yourself, I should say, you know, a lot of times the end result can be a real navel-gazing, kind of exclusive sort of thing. But the thing with your music, and then also the way you perform, which we'll talk more about a little later, is it's engaging. And it seems like you're really trying to connect with people, connect with audiences. You stare your audiences right in the eye. What is that like?
You know, when people talk about the best shows that they've ever played, a lot of times they forget that the reason that was the best show they ever played is because everyone showed up to have a good time, you know? When the audience is having fun, that energy bounces back, and you get better, and then they have more fun, and you keep getting better. I think that's something that people forget about a lot. They're like, oh, like, in theory, the best show you ever played is the one you go on stage, and you play exactly how you intended, and it's perfect. But what I find more important is to make sure everyone in the audience is connecting with me on an emotional level, like even on a physical level, where they feel what I'm trying to make them feel.
And that attitude towards making music, is that the way you've always approached it?
I mean, I don't think so. I've always loved performing in other bands. You know, I was always like the one who was moving around on stage a lot, but I always felt really tied down with an instrument. I think what I've been doing is finally just being like, you know, it's like, no, like, I should just be a performer. Like, there's other people who are better at playing instruments, and I just need to connect with the audience and tie what the musicians are doing to what the audience is feeling.
So with that energy of those performances and the confident delivery that you have, there's sometimes like a little agitation around the edges too. Like, I mean, these shows seem to be like a real release for you. With these songs, like, is there a connective tissue or kind of things that were going on in your life that provoked these songs, which seem pretty personal?
Yeah, certainly. Every musician has got some sad story, and like, I'm trying to not make TLDR about like one particular experience. There's a lot of people who like pitch records is like, oh, this is the one where like he could barely breathe and like he couldn't even get himself out of bed, but somehow he managed to record this great record or something. I mean, I just like, yeah, I had some tragedy in my life like everyone else, and my art form just happens to be music. So I definitely treat the live shows, or at least when I first started doing them, they were really cathartic. When I was building the character that people see now, it was really difficult for me to get through some performances. And I remember, like, I had a couple breakdowns, and it was hard to separate me from the character because they were kind of too similar. But now when I'm performing, I definitely go into character, and it is very cathartic, and I get done, and I'm like, okay, let's hang out now, let's have a good time. I'll let you know my secret.
A song like The Situation, the hook is undeniable. Do you remember anything about writing that song or kind of stumbling upon that keyboard riff?
That definitely was like a product of like having too much free time to record the record. You know, of course, playing with the little pitch bend knob, being like, yeah, like, I'm having fun in the studio by myself. And I kind of hit that and I was like, oh, wait a second. And going up and down the octave. And then I was like, oh, and then I can move it up like a note. It became the hook of the song. And I was like, oh, well. My friend Dax, who's in Body Games, he was listening to it. And he was like, I had it like pretty low in the mix. It was just like a background thing. And he was like, that's your lead. Like, that needs to be louder than everything else.
Oh, you like the note, but what's it say about me? It's dripping from my throat. What's his name? What's his name? Out the corner of my eye.
Some of your songs, like Raise the Gate and Let Me In, they really have a sexy sound, and that's not a word that gets thrown around a lot in the indie music world or indie scene.
Let Me In was a humanized song. It's like a cover by a band I actually play in, this guy Thomas Costello. If you listen to his version, it's really sad and lonely, because like the idea of Let Me In, for him it was kind of this like 1980s John Cusack sort of waiting out the door with the stereo over the head. Let Me In, and I want it to be more of this like physical Let Me In, you know, in like an innuendo sort of way. I feel like R&B and hip-hop seem to be the only appropriate genre to talk about sex, and everyone's kind of embarrassed about it. But it's like, rock musicians spend like 95% of the time talking about relationships, but they just talk about the bad parts, you know? And sex is one of the best parts about being a human. I'm coasting through. You can't find.
And Derek, the name of the album is TLDR, which is internet speak for too long, didn't read. Why'd you choose that to be the name of the album?
It's kind of funny. Maybe two summers ago, I was going to Busch Gardens with like six friends, okay? And I'm like a big planner, like I'm a huge planner. Like if you hang out with me, you're going to get like charts and time frames, and I'm going to tell you like where you need to get tickets to this event, like how you should buy them, the best way to get discounts, etc. So I sent out this like long email to like five of my friends who were coming this trip, like where the hotel was I booked, you know, where to do everything. Like at the very beginning of it, I said, this is really long, but read all of it and you will have no questions about this trip, you know, like like there will be zero things to ask me once, like anything that you think that might happen about this trip, just reference this long article of Busch Gardens-ness. And yeah, so like a week before the trip, I just started getting like 40 emails from people like, wait, so where do I do this? Where do I do that? You know, and I'm like, oh my God, like my plan frustratingness just like hit a wall. I just like kept on being like, read the email. And then one of my friends just said, TLDR, bored. And I was like, oh, that's the essence of the internet. And that's kind of like the essence of where we are as a culture. And as a musician who was getting ready to record a record that was going to be a pop record, I felt like I kind of had that same experience with my previous efforts. And so I've noticed that like in our sort of culture of listening to music, I've sat around people and watched them like listen to 20 seconds of a song, skip a minute in, hear the chorus, skip to the end, and then they're like, I like that. Or I hate that. And it's kind of like, you know, it's like even a pop song, it's like TLDR, like I don't have time, like let me, okay, the chorus is hooky, okay, but his voice is kind of dumb, I hate it, or I like it, you know, like, so that's kind of what TLDR means, is like, here's how do you put out a pop record in 2014 and have people like care about what you have to say, or even give you time.
You perform solo, generally live these days, but there have been a couple of full band performances lately, most notably your Hopscotch concert, which a lot of people online have been talking about. You had Aerial Dancers, and I'd like to know what it takes to translate these songs to a full band. And then also, what is it like to toggle between the two different modes, you know, of Towers now?
As far as getting a band together, it was really easy. And all I did was I found a really talented band that already existed. That band was Dad and Dad. I found a couple extra friends who played with them in other projects. And then I gave them my record, essentially, and my other records. And I was like, learn these songs and you are Towers, the cover band. And they learned them, and we just had like 5 or 6 practices where I sat in the center and I basically like listened and sang along. And of course I had to make a few corrections, and I would just like tweak it when it needed tweaking. And as far as the transition from the solo to the band effort, it wasn't very hard, because live with the pre-recordings, I am doing all these dance moves and I'm basically following the track. But when I'm doing those same dance moves with a band, they're following me. They're following my tempo, my body movements, and I kind of become like the maestro just by nature of like my movements. But I'm not doing anything different. They're just staring at me instead of me listening to the track.
I appreciate you taking the time to talk with me today.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Eddie.
Towers is playing a record release party this Saturday at The Garage. For more info and to hear tracks from the album TLDR, visit WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. TLDR is being released on Fuzz Records, the label started by Philip Pledger and Drew Braden, which began as an offshoot of the Fuzz Fest Music Festival and as a way to release their band Estrangers LP. Philip and Drew stopped by to talk about the Towers release and the first year of Fuzz Records. So has Fuzz Records been a year now?
Yeah, something like that.
Whenever Seasons came out.
Yeah, last summer.
So now that you're a year in, how do you feel about what you got yourselves into?
We have overcommitment issues.
Okay.
We've decided. That's great. Feeling North Carolina's got a lot of extremely talented bands, and it's cool to be able to be a part of that.
Yeah, I don't feel like we're over our head yet, but that could change in the future.
Yeah, I mean, we're a small label, so trying to just do sustainable quality over quantity kind of thing and promoting each release to the fullest. So we released our record last summer, which you were kind enough to have us on your show last year, which has been really cool. That was our first ever experience with the vinyl ordering process. So it kind of served as an education of sorts that informed our later releases. So this past summer, we released a 7-inch by The Tills, which is an Asheville band. If you haven't seen them live, they're just an incredibly high-energy, raucous, fun rock band.
And when you released that, you did something cool with the release show too, right?
Yeah, basically what we did was if you came to the release shows, you got a free record, which there was a lot of calculations that went into that to see how it could work and how it could fail utterly. But it actually went pretty well. I think it was a new idea for a lot of people, and it's a pretty cool memento. Like, you know, sometimes you get like stickers or something, but to walk away with actual, you know, red vinyl record, I think most people had a lot of fun with it. So those shows were awesome, and that release has been doing pretty well.
And we like the release shows to be something special and more, like you said, just getting more than just a sticker, but getting the release itself, then you can be excited about the album and not just the awesome show that you went to.
Yeah, I think it's important to make release shows feel like events instead of just another performance.
So your next release is the new Towers record. So what do you have planned for the release show for that night?
As was mentioned earlier, Derek Scott, an 8-piece band, which is, you know, it's not going to always, Towers is not always going to be that format. So that in and of itself is pretty special. At Hopscotch, it was a pretty amazing sight to behold that many people on the stage and, you know, that big of a sound. It was just really cool. So I think people that have seen Derek at the Texas Pete Fest or the Pride Parade that have seen his solo act, I think the translation to the 8-piece band will be a really cool thing to see. So that'll be awesome.
Do you have some other releases upcoming after Towers? Obviously, you're spending a lot of time and a lot of energy on the Towers release, and it already seems like it's getting some good press and everything out there, which is great for him and great for the label. But what's coming up next? I'm sure you're looking ahead.
We've had people send us things, and feel free to send us your new albums, bands.
Unsolicited demo recordings? Oh, you friendly young record label? That's amazing. If you're listening to this, that's pretty amazing.
There's certainly some things that we've gotten and we've listened to and we're interested in. We can't necessarily always work them out with the timeline of the band or our own timeline, but there's definitely some prospects we're thinking about. We might do like a split 7-inch sooner than later.
Yeah, we've got a couple ideas for that thematically, kind of a series thing that we're entertaining. But yeah, there's a couple other bands that we've been in touch with whose records we really, really like. So, Estrangers will be making a new record in this winter. So hopefully for like a late summer release next year.
Supposedly.
All right, cool. Well, I look forward to everything you guys do, everything you release. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Eddie.
Thanks.
Philip Pledger and Drew Braden. They run Fuzz Records, the Winston-Salem-based record label behind the Towers release TLDR. For more on Towers and Fuzz Records, visit WFDD.org and click on Try It Arts Weekend.
Technical producer Eddie Garcia. This is Try It Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Jazz Times calls him a consummate improviser, and AllAboutJazz.com says his music is wholly satisfying. Saxophonist and UNC Greensboro Associate Professor of Music Chad Eby has just completed a wholly satisfying new CD inspired by the poetry of Shel Silverstein. The Sweet Shel Suite features Chad on tenor, alto, and soprano sax, alongside his all-star colleagues Brandon Lee on trumpet, bassist Steve Haynes, and outstanding UNCG alumnus Daniel Faust on drums. That's Ickle Me, Pickle Me, Tickle Me 2 from the new album. Chad's association with Silverstein's poetry dates back to early childhood and collections like Where the Sidewalk Ends. But Chad says he became even more attached to the poems as an adult, reading them aloud to his children.
My son in particular was the first one who was taken to it, my eldest son, Spencer. He always loved the word games, he loved the silly pictures, but Spencer's also an old soul, and so he understood the depth behind some of these poems, actually from a pretty young age. He was the first person who mentioned to me that one of the poems called The Long-Haired Boy was sort of about bullying. So there's always a deeper message to these poems. And I like the way adults can be deeply moved by the more powerful, buried messages and how children can be attracted to them just because they're silly. It's one of those things where you can really foster a love for these things over the course of your entire lifetime. The Long-Haired Boy is a very bittersweet poem about a long-haired boy who the townsfolk in the place where he lives, they make fun of him and point at him and tease him for his hair. He goes off in solitude and starts to cry so violently that his head shakes and his hair starts to flap around, and he realizes that his hair is lifting him up into the sky and he's able to fly. And so he flies and soars around the town, and all of a sudden, now that he's the boy who can fly, everybody in the town wants a piece of him. They're all like calling to him, hey, come down here, we want to talk to you. The mayor wants to give him the key to the city, and the boy just keeps soaring back and forth and listening to all this, and finally at the end he just says, man, I'm done with you guys, and he just flies off into the sunset. You know, it's obviously a parable about finding what's special about you and finding your future through that. ¶¶
you and Brandon seem so much on the same page here. I love the solo handoff. What's it like handing off your vision for a piece, for example, to Brandon, or in this case, later on, Steve Haynes and mm-hmm. his great bass solo?
Well, I have complete and ultimate trust in all three of these musicians on this album. I've seen how they work. We have many things in common pedagogically. We tend to like, for the most part, the same types of music. So when I wrote these songs, I had the three of them in mind and nobody else. So it's very easy for me to cede authority on these tunes to those guys because I believe so much in them musically.
Years from now, when I am gone, and you begin this really sentimental tune with Steve Haynes, his beautiful, sentimental sounding bass solo, it's powerful on a lot of levels, not least of which the fact that a year ago, Steve couldn't have played a note of that solo.
Right. You know, Steve just went through one of those things for a musician that's terrifying. He was facing the prospect that he was never going to play again because he lost all use of his right arm. This is the first recording he's done since the successful surgery. And, you know, he was, throughout that recovery process, recovering how to play the bass again and rediscovering his skills, he was constantly apologizing for, oh, I'm so out of tune, I'm sorry, oh, my sound is not right, it'll get better. And I was just like, man, I'm just so glad you're playing. You know, I'll take your struggles to get back over playing with any other bass player playing at their best.
I love the, it's a nice switch to soprano sax on this tune. And it's some tenor players I've heard, you know, play soprano because they have to or something mm-hmm. like that. But you've got a really nice soprano sound and approach. How does soprano change your approach, for lack of a better way of putting that, to improvising or any number of ways you do what you do?
Well, you know, it's tricky. I think all saxophone players wrestle with, when they switch from one instrument to the next, do I sound the same just at a different pitch level on the other instrument? You know, the soprano saxophone plays an octave higher than the tenor. And the idea is that, you know, at least the goal is that you're going to sound the same, just an octave higher. So my goal is to do that, to actually just sort of sound like me. But I realize all the time that I'm still a product of my influences. I love the soprano saxophone playing of Sidney Bechet, Steve Lacy, Branford Marsalis, Wayne Shorter. Those are my favorite soprano saxophone sounds. So I think that what comes out of me when I play the soprano is more of an amalgamation of those four sounds filtered through me. And my tenor playing sounds like a slightly different bag of influences, I think. So I'm still kind of wrestling with that personally inside. Am I really doing this right if I don't sound exactly the same off by an octave, you know?
Does it free you up at all?
To play the soprano? No, actually, because it's much harder to play.
Intonation-wise? Or
yeah, since the instrument is smaller, small changes in the way you form your mouth or the way you use your air, small changes create drastic differences in intonation and tone quality and timbre. So it's actually very difficult to play well. And so I guess I'm just always just sort of hoping to sort of get somewhere in the ballpark of playing it well. So, you know, throw it at the wall and see what sticks, you know?
Lester, the Wish Waster. Mm-hmm. It's a great duet work on this tune. What's it like working with Brandon Lee?
Brandon is a world-class trumpet player. I firmly believe he's in the top, you know, he's a one percenter, you know, in the jazz trumpet world. We're very blessed to have him in the triad. He's a colleague of mine at UNCG. He's a good friend. He's easy to work with. He's honest and open about his opinions about the music, both the music that we are teaching to our students and the music that we are composing as colleagues. And he brings a really intense musical focus to the bandstand all the time without being difficult to be around. We have a great time hanging out together. We have similar senses of humor, similar tastes in, you know, movies and TV shows and things like that. So it really is a friendship that I value very, very much.
Before reading the song title or really the synopsis of this tune, I thought I heard a few Lester Youngish sounds in there.
Sure, but yeah.
I'd be hard-pressed to explain what made me think of him other than you're just making really hard improv sound very easy and at times funny. Who was Lester?
Well, the Lester of the poem, in particular, if we go there first, Lester is a person who makes wishes, and well, he rubs a bottle and the genie comes out and offers him wishes, and he wishes for more wishes, and he does this basically until he stockpiles so many wishes that he can't do anything with them, and then he dies.
You can't take it with you.
Right, exactly. You can't take it with you. So one of my primary influences on the saxophone is Lester Young, who's sort of the great grandfather of modern jazz saxophone playing. Who was in the Count Basie Orchestra in the 1930s and then went on to a short solo career before dying, I believe, in 1959. But he was heavily influential on the music of Charlie Parker, heavily influential on the music of an entire generation of saxophonists like Stan Getz and Zoot Sims, Al Cohn. But what I love about Lester Young's improvising is that he brings an elegant simplicity to the music without losing any sense of swing, without losing a sense of there being meaning to what he's playing. You know, he would sometimes dance around the harmony in a way that made it sound like he maybe didn't know what the chords were. And it's entirely possible that some of the time he didn't, but it didn't matter because the direction of his melody that he was improvising cured all those problems along the way. And for me, that's the most important thing, is that for me, melody comes first, you know, and harmony has to be secondary, you know, because when people whistle a song to you, they don't whistle, you know, the chords to you. They whistle the melody, and that's what they remember. So melody's first to me, and that was first to Lester Young.
I love how you start off with melodically in that style, and then it goes all the way through to the, as you mentioned, the dissonant demise of poor
right.
Lester and his wish yeah. falling through the cracks.
You know, that tune was written in such a way, there's these three or four short melodic fragments, you know, maybe just two beats here, maybe a measure there, and they gradually just start to compress and pile up on top of each other. You mentioned the duet quality that Brandon and I have on that tune. Especially in the last, you know, 10 or 12 bars of the melody, things really sort of pile up and it becomes hard to tell who's playing, Brandon or I, because it's all overlapping and layering, and then it definitely does end with a little bit of a bite, yeah.
Saxophonist and UNC Greensboro Associate Professor of Music, Chad Eby. We've been sampling from his new album, The Sweet Shel Suite, music inspired by Shel Silverstein. It's truly an awesome jazz album. Even the album cover is cool. It's an original drawing of the quartet, Steve Haynes, Brandon Lee, Chad Eby, and Daniel Faust, by Emily Maynard, and it was drawn in the unmistakable style of Shel Silverstein. You can check it out on our website, wfdd.org, and click on Triad Arts Weekend. The Chad Eby Quartet Album Release Concert is Saturday night, November 15th at 8 o'clock in the UNCG School of Music Recital Hall. Incredibly, this performance, with some of the finest jazz musicians you're liable to hear, is free and open to the public. There will be CDs for sale there, of course, and you'll find links to more on our website. Again, that's WFDD.org, and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. You know, to make it in the classical music world today, well, just like the jazz world, you've got to be pretty amazing. Bring your violin to a typical symphony audition, and depending on the group, you might find yourself warming up alongside, 400 or more other equally determined violinists, just as hungry as you are and ready to duke it out for one chair in the orchestra. But at least there are lots of violinists in every orchestra, and they do tend to move around from orchestra to orchestra occasionally. Now picture a conductor audition. First off, there's only one music director in an orchestra, and after years and years of training, guest conducting, assistant conducting, and waiting on the bench, once they've got the gig, an orchestra all their own, conductors are not really all that anxious to leave. My next guest has not only lived in that world for much of his life, he has thrived there. Christopher James Lees made his debut with the LA Philharmonic, one of the world's finest orchestras, as a recipient of the prestigious Dudamel Fellowship. Conductor Gustavo Dudamel is the 21st century version of Leonard Bernstein. The 33-year-old Venezuelan LA Phil music director truly is all that and a bag of chips. Anywho, Gustavo loves Christopher James Lee's conducting work, and so will you. He's now in his 14th week leading the UNC School of the Arts Orchestra, where he's also Associate Professor of Conducting. This weekend, Christopher James Lees will lead the orchestra in a performance of Sir Edward Elgar's Enigma Variations and Benjamin Britten's Young Person's Guide to the Orchestra. In my experience, it seems like there have been very few who have risen to this level of writing a work that introduces the orchestra in a way that is educational and entertaining at the level of Britten's Young Person's Guide to the Orchestra. And in this case, add to that mix, you get a celebrity narrator. It should be a lot of fun.
Yeah, I chose the piece precisely because it puts the spotlight on every instrumental studio in the orchestra. And it seemed like, you know, Chancellor Bierman is new, I'm new, the second half being Enigma Variations. It's all about friendship, and it's all about what happens when we come together and the kind of magic we can create that's greater than the sum of its parts.
This work, I would throw Peter and the Wolf in that category of really shining a light on each section of the orchestra in a way that's just memorable and fun and challenging for the students, too. The music is not easy for the Young Person's Guide. Each section gets a chance to do some gymnastics.
They jump through some flaming hoops of doom in different moments over the span of about 16 to 18 minutes. The real apotheosis of the piece is not just when they deconstruct and everybody gets their moment, but when it gets reassembled. The analogy of the orchestra is one that this piece certainly illuminates, but we are constantly bombarded in our world with images of people being completely inhumane to one another. And then you're presented with a medium like the orchestra, where every instrument sounds different, every person playing it comes from a different lineage, a different part of the world, and yet when they come together, they create human harmony. And when you do that, it becomes a model and a kind of allegory for what could be possible. And so this piece is intended not just to be a great showpiece, which it is, and not just to feature our new chancellor, which it does, but also to provide the students a glimpse into what's possible out in the world.
I like the connector too. We've got a couple of theme and variations on the program, and this one, the great theme from Henry Purcell from way way back that Britten picks up, and when it all comes together at the end, that huge fugue, it's talk about triumphant sounds.
It's magical. I mean, I always equate the fugue to a kind of relay race where somebody has a piece of musical material, they take a lap, they hand it to the next person, and they run with it. And to see that start at the very top of the score with the piccolo, all the way through the percussion section, and have it come back in this powerful and emotionally gripping climax with the theme of Purcell superimposed. There's nothing like it.
The Enigma Variations, Sir Edward Elgar, it's kind of interesting. It's the Enigma part he took to his death. I mean, the mystery surrounding, you know, who's who, what the symbology was. But evidently it came from fairly humble beginnings, just kind of noodling around on the keyboard.
He was tinkering at his piano one day and his wife said, "That sounds good."
"I'll take it."
And he said, "Maybe I should use that." And from that came this grand kind of mystery that is still debated. I mean, the number and types of different pieces that claim to work well as a counterpoint to the original theme are vast and varied, and some of them are absolutely hilarious. I mean, the fact that you could play this theme at New Year's and play Auld Lang Syne on top of it, and then you've got, you know, perfect counterpoint, seems like a fun party trick after a bottle of champagne or two.
Variations. The theme itself is really kind of haunting and beautiful. I mean, you can see why his wife said, "Oh, that's really neat. You got to use that." But of the 14, a particular favorite you could share with us?
Well, the one that I am most emotionally gripped by, maybe it's just because I'm used to looking at things from, you know, what we call eagle vision, from high above the ground, is the finale when, you know, in the finale, he takes all, or at least many of the themes, the variations, and the people that have been included earlier, puts them together, and it becomes this whirlwind of color and musical material, which becomes the climax of this man's life. You know, if you had to express friendship, he does it one at a time, but then he does it all together. And that, to me, is really emotionally overwhelming, because like Dorothy spinning through the air on her way to Oz, you see the faces of, in Elgar's case, you see his wife, you see one of his best friends, amateur musicians he played alongside, people with unique personality and speech impediment quirks, all spinning around each other in a kind of grand Elgar, you know, Edward, this is your life presentation. The conglomerate, the aggregate of that is really powerful for me.
UNC School of the Arts Orchestra Music Director Christopher James Lees. Wow. Talk about your enthusiastic arts advocate. I mean, that guy makes me feel like I've got to snap out of it, get with the program, and sing it from the highest mountaintops. Classical music rocks. It really does, by the way, and if you or your kids have never heard a live orchestra, you gotta go. And you can, this weekend. Yep, you can see Christopher in action, up on the podium, waving his baton and leading the UNCSA Orchestra this Saturday night in the Stevens Center, 405 West 4th Street in Winston-Salem. The concert of music by Britten and Elgar kicks off at 7:30, and you'll find links to ticket information and more at WFDD.org, and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and associate producer Bethany Chafin will take it from here.
Singer-songwriter Heather Maloney has a dynamic, expressive sound that she says is influenced by adventure folk. Her lyrics, as the Huffington Post writes, cut to the chase. Music writer and New York Times contributor Val Haller noticed her voice. "If I'd closed my eyes," she writes, "it could have been Joni Mitchell." Maloney will be bringing her insightful lyrics and memorable voice to Winston-Salem next week when she performs as part of Roots Revival. Maloney is currently at work on her next full-length album, and she spoke with me by phone from Nashville.
We can buy our lot, we can mark our spot, but we're travelers whether we like it or not. So please make my castle out of sand.
You spent several years at a silent retreat meditation center, and I wonder if you could tell me and our listeners a little bit about that experience for you and how it has subsequently sort of affected your writing or been involved in your writing at all.
I spent just about 3 years living and working at that center, and I really couldn't articulate this at the time, but I think I was looking for a way to kind of capture and communicate and celebrate some of the experiences and insights and life lessons that were being presented to me and I was finally starting to get. And I just couldn't really think of a way to keep those lessons other than writing a song. It just felt like a really way to sort of capture something and take it with you. I had been journaling, so I guess that's kind of close. I had been journaling and writing poetry informally, and that didn't quite feel like enough, you know, expression. So I think that's where the singing came in. Do you read Rumi poetry at all?
Yeah.
He has a poem that he says that poetry tries to touch the divine and it doesn't quite get there. And in this poem, he's saying that he thinks that music is the closest you can get before you're obliterated. You know, I really love his view on music like that. Like, it's just really ecstatic.
He left seaside daisies on her porch every day for weeks until she showed.
Okay, well, back to this past year. One of the really great collaborations it seems you've had has been with the group Darling Side. And yeah. I wonder how you all began to work together, because some great things have obviously come from that, including your cover of Joni Mitchell's song Woodstock, and you released an EP together. So tell me about that experience of working with them.
Every way in which our musical paths have crossed in the past year, everything from that point forth has been incredibly serendipitous, and I have some pretty crazy karma with that band. We did a tour in November exactly a year ago, and on that tour we ended up doing a house concert in Chicago at a friend of mine, Val Haller's house. And Val Haller is a music writer. She has a music column for the New York Times. It's really great, and she's really great. Her whole spiel is that she's kind of there to connect the baby boomer generation with the generations of new music that are coming. And she does that by comparing, you know, those classic acts with new acts by saying, like, you know, if you like Bob Dylan, you might like Tallest Man on Earth. Familiarizing people with new sounds by using names that they recognize. So we did the show at her house while we were in Chicago on that first tour together. And after the show, she said, Darling Side reminded her of Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young with their four-part harmonies, and that I reminded her of Joni Mitchell. So obviously we were pretty touched because those are some idols. And she said, well, hey, why don't you do a music video singing Woodstock, since Joni Mitchell wrote it and Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young covered it and helped make it famous. As soon as we got home from that first tour last November, we made the video, and a couple weeks later, she put it up in the Times. And then within that week, somebody had passed it along to Graham Nash, who seemed to love it. And a month after that, serendipitously, he was at a conference that both myself and Darling Side flew out to in Kansas City called Folk Alliance. And during his keynote speech, he told the whole audience to go watch that video. So we were like, oh, wow. My gosh. Everything sort of happened like that, like dominoes with them, not forced at all, and musically and personally, you know, a really fulfilling experience to have gotten to connect with them in those ways. So, yeah, they hold a dear place in my heart.
Well, I came upon a child of God. He was walking along the road.
Did you know that your voice was going to be that well suited to cover a Joni Mitchell song? Because it is. It's amazing.
Thank you.
Did you know that there could have been that comparison, or was that completely new to hear?
I definitely have gotten Joni Mitchell comparisons, and I think that it's been an inevitable thing. You know, I wouldn't personally compare myself to her because she seems like an inhuman to me. She seems like an amazing creature. But, you know, I grew up singing her songs and learned how to sing by listening to her, and so it was sort of definitely going to be an audible influence. When, you know, Val suggested that we cover that song, I was like, heck yes. And, you know, I know the song well, and I've been singing along to for years, so...
Let's look forward a little bit, and congratulations on meeting your Kickstarter goal for your new album. And you're welcome. Yeah, tell me a little bit about where you are right now. You're just beginning to record that.
Yes, indeed. So I'm in Nashville here for 10 days working on the new record, and so far it's been incredible. Basically, immediately, I knew that the team that I've ended up with is going to do this album and these songs justice, which means a lot because these songs, for whatever reason, hold like a particularly special place in my heart. So handing something over to a group, that some of which you've never worked with before, and knowing immediately that you can trust them with those really precious things, it's such a great feeling.
I understand Bill Reynolds of Band of Horses is producing it. Is that right?
Yeah, he's definitely a member of the Dream Team. He's just got incredible ideas. I've been a Band of Horses fan for a couple of years, so even just getting past the moment of being starstruck, it's like, wow, this is a really talented person who has incredible ideas and is going to be able to execute them. So, and that's what you want in a producer. So beyond him being a part of that stellar band, he's just an incredible producer. Super honored to have him making this record what it will be.
Don't want a promise that outlives the promiser, and my body will not last longer than a metal band.
Heather Maloney will be performing as part of Roots Revival Stage on November 19th at Centenary United Methodist Church. There will be a brief worship service centered on one of Heather's songs, followed by an hour-long concert. This event is free and open to the public, but guests are asked to reserve a space online. For more information and to see videos of Heather playing, visit our website at WFGD.org. Once there, click on Triad Arts Weekend.
Associate Producer Bethany Chafin. Well, that's it for today's show. It was a pretty good one, wasn't it? Well, tell us about it. We'd love to hear from you. Send your questions, comments, and suggestions to triadarts@wfu.edu. Our technical producer is Eddie Garcia. Our associate producer is Bethany Chafin. And our intern is Jorge Clifton. You'll find podcasts, archived episodes, links to all the artists, and more on our website, wfdd.org. I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.